From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, close to 1.5 million Facebook users checked in to the same place, the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in Cannonball, North Dakota, where protesters have been camping out for months to stymie construction of the North Dakota Access Pipeline through a major water source and sacred tribal lands. Check-ins announce one's physical presence at a location, but no, there wasn't a mass exodus to the Peace Garden State. It was a tactic, a misdirection campaign.
The surge followed reports that said police were using Facebook to identify and target protesters.
The post is meant to overwhelm and confuse sheriff's deputies who are allegedly using Facebook check-ins to determine who's at the protest camp.
The Morton County Sheriff's Department claims that it, quote, is not and does not follow Facebook check-ins for the protest camp or any location. Nonetheless, by overwhelming social media feeds with a virtual human wave, the check-ins finally attracted mainstream media to a story and a location they'd scarcely noticed. Candy Mossett is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network and has been part of the encampment since August. She believes the Facebook check-in meme finally brought the protest the attention it deserves. But don't ask her where the idea came from.
You know, honestly, we don't really know. People keep asking, and we're asking each other, who started this? Was it Sacred Stone Camp? And they were like, no, it wasn't us. Was it the Indigenous Environmental Network? We said, no, we didn't start it. I got some random messages on Facebook Messenger that said, this is what we're going to do, check in. And I thought, okay, you know, it's not really that big of a deal. They can tell through geo mapping where people actually are and where they're checking in from. But we knew that we were being watched. We know that they have equipment out here called stingrays and other equipment where they're getting information off of our cell phones. So at first, the Facebook check-in thing, for many of us, we were just like, it's not that big of a deal. Sure, go ahead, check in or don't check in. Now that it's gone viral and it's causing attention around the world, people want to know more about the story. They're like, why are so many people checking in? So it has actually turned out to be a really brilliant idea, and none of us seem to know who's behind it.
While the commitment of the protesters has been ongoing, the attention from the outside world has been, at best, uneven. What is it like to make the commitment for this ongoing encampment, which really is more or less invisible to the outside world?
I am not aware, necessarily being in the camp, that it's invisible to the outside world, because this is our reality and we're living it every day. In the camp itself, we do our best through Indigenous Rising Media to try to put out the stories and to try to have journalists and people come to help us tell the story to the outside world. In fact, we had a very long email from a publicist who said our press releases are very not very media savvy. And so then we asked this person, can you come work with us then? Because we're doing the best we can as Indigenous on the ground media, and that's what we have to work with. So we are at the mercy of the police who are putting out statements and are much more savvy than we are, but we're trying.
Is the story that is going out the one that you think is the right story to tell?
I think that the story that's going out is more based around the violence that's happening. It's almost like a catch-22. We don't want the violence to happen, but also that's why so many people came, is because they saw what was happening to us. I want the story to go out about the bigger picture. There is no guarantee that you're going to win against an injustice that happens to you when you speak out. But we are guaranteed to fail if we don't at least try.
Once I was interviewing the head of some liver association, and I asked him if in his heart of hearts, secretly, he wished for some major celebrity, like Lady Gaga or something, to get hepatitis so that he would have a human face to put on the matter of liver disease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he hemmed and hawed before saying, well, no, I don't actually wish any disease on anyone, but it really is good to have a celebrity spokesman. And I'm wondering if somewhere in your heart of hearts, it's like, yeah, I'm kind of glad this oil company and the state of North Dakota are conspiring to do us harm, because it really focuses the issue.
No, not at all, because if it wasn't this fight, it would be another fight. Prior to this, we were fighting the Sandpiper Pipeline. Enbridge pulled out and put all of their money into Dakota Access. Prior to that, we were fighting the Keystone XL Pipeline, in which we were successful, and we won. Prior to that, I'm living in the Bakken oil fields, where I'm seeing women and children all around me being raped by the increase in man camps coming into our communities. I'm not glad that it's happening. None of us even want to be there. We just don't have a choice. Because this is our reality every day as Native people, as people of color, as minorities. We are where the extraction zones are, and we're sick. We have cancer. We have asthma. I'm a cancer survivor. That's our reality. I used to think it was normal until I left the reservation and found out that's not normal. There has to be an awakening, and it's just really sad that it takes something this dramatic and this violent for that awakening to happen.
Candy, many thanks.
Matsigirads, thank you.
Candy Mossett is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. If the Facebook check-ins generated attention, the next question is, to what end? Construction is almost complete, while the Army Corps of Engineers has yet to grant the company permission to install the final short stretch of pipeline beneath a Missouri River reservoir, and while President Obama has mused publicly about rerouting that section altogether, protesters are reckoning with the possibility of losing this battle, but gaining advantage in the war.
We're glad that people have finally noticed Standing Rock and noticed North Dakota, because pretty much North Dakota and South Dakota compete for how bad you could treat Native people.
Winona LaDuke is a longtime environmental and indigenous rights activist and the executive director of Honor the Earth.
Whether it's unequal sentencing, whether it's the fact that you have a 70% poverty rate, whether it's the fact that the Standing Rock Tribe's clinic was built in the 1950s. They only have four doctors for 8,000 people.
We spoke to LaDuke on Wednesday, and she described the front lines.
So now what has happened is that they've spent $6.9 million or so on militarizing, bringing in mine-resistant anti-personnel vehicles, rubber bullet shooters, things that bust your eardrums with some sound barriers. The state of North Dakota has encouraged and secured police from 12 states. From what I understand, there's about 900 officers that have been deployed. In the meantime, they don't have a permit to cross the river with the DAPL pipeline. They have everything up until that. And they have plowed through grave sites, over sacred areas, plowed through basically people just for the benefit of a pipeline.
Is there a chance that the Army Corps of Engineers will not be able to permit that small remaining segment?
Yes, there is a chance. And we are hoping that that occurs because they had the opportunity, if you call it that, to run the pipeline just north of the city of Bismarck. But they chose not to. Instead, they decided to put it in the poorest county in North Dakota, just next to the Standing Rock Reservation. And so the Army Corps of Engineers has been watching, you know, and has not given the last permit out. They have reasons to not give that permit, including a full violation of the National Historic Preservation Act by DAPL, by plowing through all of those graves, plowing through the sacred sites.
In fact, let me just recapitulate. There's three basic issues here. One is the incursion into sacred tribal burial grounds. The second is the environmental issue. And the third is the whole question of sovereignty on Indian lands, that this whole enterprise seems to unilaterally abrogate treaties between the United States government and the tribes. Is there any long-term satisfaction to be gained on any of these issues?
I think that we've let a lot of blood, and I think that that blood should be worth something. I just want to point out, this is the pipeline from nowhere. I'm not sure that they'll ever have oil in that pipeline. This is coming from the Bakken, and the Bakken oil fields have, in fact, busted. This is a pipeline with no oil to put in it. I'm driving from Standing Rock to my reservation right now, and my reservation is facing a 760,000-barrel-a-day tar sands pipeline. And it's the same company that I'm fighting. And so I am in the middle of a major war over the infrastructure of North America, of which Standing Rock is the place that people have noticed that there's a problem. And in our prophecies, we talk about this time as the time of a choice between two paths. One path is well-worn but scorched. The other path is not well-worn and it is green. And it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And that's a prophecy of the Anishinaabe people from a long time ago. And I think that Standing Rock shows that people can have courage, people can stand up to tanks, and people can stand there in the middle of the prairie with no cell service and get terrorized by police and say, you can't do that to us, and we are not afraid of you. That's what Standing Rock is to me.
I want to go all Saul Alinsky on you. As a strategic matter, you have, at least momentarily, the world's attention, and the Standing Rock standoff is not going to last forever. What do you do with what you have managed to coalesce around this pipeline?
Well, what advice would you give us? You're the one who asked the question. I mean,
my instinct is to set up a food truck. So you're talking to the wrong guy. I think too small.
Right. Okay. So you got the Saul Alinsky theory, but no practice, basically. Okay. I'm working with the tribal government and the tribal college, which is called the Sitting Bull Tribal College. And I believe that they need basically a Sitting Bull plan, like the equivalent of the Marshall Plan. The famous Sitting Bull quote is, let us put our minds together to see what kind of future we can make for our children. Famous Sitting Bull quote. And that's basically where we're at. Standing Rock is the crossroads of fossil fuel extraction, everything that is bad about it, and everything that is potential. They have immense solar and wind potential. Everything that you basically need to build a sustainable community in the Northern Plains, a lot of those experts are out there at the camp or coming in. And so we intend to leverage them for the tribe.
In the introduction, we discussed the Facebook episode where more than a million people have used the check-in function to announce to the world that they are at Standing Rock. Are the actual protesters at Standing Rock aware of the virtual throngs that surround them?
They are. And one thing that happened, I was meeting with the tribal chairman and Jody Gillette, who works with the tribal chairman. And we were talking about the fact that people had been arrested and housed in dog kennels and such things. And she said, you know, I didn't even get to thank New York City. Because what happened is the New York City Council passed a resolution supporting the people at Standing Rock and supporting the Standing Rock tribe. And she was saying, you know, it made us cry when it came in, that New York City noticed us. And I kind of cried, too, when I heard her say that, because I feel like that we are really grateful for people noticing us, but also wanting to support us. And I know that a million Facebook users are checking a box. We're hoping that you're sending letters to, you know, the governor of North Dakota and making sure that more police don't come out here. And we're hoping that you stay in touch with the Standing Rock tribe. We're going to build the renewable energy economy on Standing Rock. We're going to get that tribe a clinic, a full-on hospital, actually, is what they need. And so we want you to stay with us and support us.
Winona, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a really good day.
Winona LaDuc, former Green Party vice presidential candidate, is the executive director of Honor the Earth. Coming up, the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. Or not. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. By now, we all know the story. The Russians are coming. For our emails specifically, and our democracy in general. We know they hacked the DNC. We read about that in the Washington Post. And we know that they're probably behind the Podesta emails. We read about that in the New York Times. And we know that they're doing all of this to try to tip the election in the favor of Donald Trump. We've heard that from everyone, the media, the intelligence community, the White House, even presidential candidate Hillary Clinton herself. It's one of those things where we're so sure that we know it, we almost forget to ask how we know it. To which cybersecurity analyst Jeffrey Carr says, we don't.
There is evidence that the hackers who attacked the DNC were probably Russian-speaking and or used Russian-made tools. But what is missing is the connection between the Russian-speaking, Russian-made tools and so on with Russian intelligence agencies. Russia has an incredibly profitable cyber criminal infrastructure performing acts of industrial espionage for people who hire them.
It's kind of like if the Lucchese family were shaking down restaurants for protection money. It's an American outfit doing business in America, no connection to the CIA.
Right. Russian Ministry of Communication issued a report on Russian organized crime activities and said that they see approximately 40% of the $1 billion or more that's earned by Russian cyber criminals gets reinvested into software development. So how can you tell using digital forensics and just looking at the malware that was used in any given attack, if what you're looking at was developed in a lab run by the Russian government or in a lab run by Russian criminals? You know, you can't.
The attacks of the DNC were launched using a Russian email address. And one of the documents was modified by a user, one of the hackers, whose code name was the founder of the Soviet secret police.
Exactly. It's a comic book. It's Boris and Natasha. There is not a single professional intelligence service in the world that would run a secret operation using their own country's servers, using email addresses from their country's most popular email provider, using tools that have the signature of a Russian developer. I mean, maybe one mistake, fine. But you've got like a half a dozen mistakes, right? Major mistakes. So on the one hand, you have evidence that says these guys must be completely incompetent and the Keystone Cops version of intelligence agents. On the other hand, you have Washington saying Russia is highly sophisticated technologically and we should be afraid. Now, how do you have both of those exist at the same time?
Notwithstanding your reservations about the persuasiveness of the evidence, when the intelligence community tells us they know something, and let's just say we're not discussing aluminum tubes, all right, and they keep saying it over and over, no, 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 we've got the goods, is it possible that they have goods that you're unaware of that put the smoking gun in the hands of Vladimir Putin?
Absolutely. It's certainly possible. And we saw that with Sony, right? Sony and the North Koreans. In that case, the NSA actually said, we are 100% convinced, due to sources that we cannot disclose, that the North Korean government was involved. I certainly wouldn't have any means to argue against that. Those are classified sources, and if they are backing it 100%, then terrific. But that was not said about this attack.
You think that if they absolutely had the goods, they would have said exactly that as they did in the Sony hack?
I think so, yeah.
The danger, at least to you, as I understand it, is that all of this smoke causes someone to fire because there's been a lot of saber rattling or, I don't know, malware rattling, which says that the United States should take action against Russia for its alleged behavior during this election period. You don't believe that there's nearly enough evidence for any kind of retaliatory cyber attack?
Well, it's a moot point now. The U.S. has officially charged Russia for attempting to manipulate our election. And in international law, we've already established that a cyber attack is a use of force. Therefore, the U.S. government, by charging Russia, is saying that we are now entitled to use force that is proportionate against you. And once that begins to scale up, you can't stop it. And this is not some little backwoods country. This is a major world player. This is, in my opinion, a highly dangerous and even irresponsible approach to handling our cyber issues with Russia.
And then there's the sort of moral authority question. We have also engaged in cyber warfare, embedding the Stuxnet virus in the Iranian centrifuges. So even if the Russians are behind this, I guess we don't necessarily have the right to be shocked that a power would be creating mischief against another.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, the U.S. has been outed for quite a number of government-run cyber operations around the world. It wasn't just Stuxnet. There are now dozens, if not hundreds, of operations that could be laid at the feet of the NSA because of the release of information most recently by this group known as shadow brokers. So yeah, where's the moral high ground? I don't know.
Just to be clear, this could very well be the Russian government. You're just not sure, and your concern is that we have made a judgment based on far too little physical evidence.
That's right. It's not possible to rule out the Russian government as somehow controlling or performing the attack. My concern is that the standard of evidence for when governments accuse one another needs to be high. And historically, it has been high. This incident, however, sets a very low bar, and we must demand a better quality or a better standard of evidence.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Carr is a cybersecurity consultant, author of Inside Cyber Warfare, and founder of the consulting company, the 20K League. Of course, the hacking of Democratic emails is but one subplot of a much larger narrative, that Donald Trump is some sort of Manchurian candidate under the thrall of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And this week, finally, we smelled the smoking gun.
Slate says that computer scientists have been looking into possible communication between a server belonging to Trump and two servers registered to a major Russian bank.
There's a very strong story between Trump servers and Russia.
It took cyber experts about 5 minutes to knock that story down. According to the New York Times, the FBI already had. But was Slate and the U.S. press in general too accepting of such a premise? And does the press operate under lower standards of evidence where Russia is concerned? James Carden, contributor to The Nation and executive editor of the American Committee for East-West Accord, says, oh yeah.
Donald Trump has brought this in a way upon himself because he's repeatedly said how much he admires Putin, and he's made some odd comments. When they were on 60 Minutes, they had separate segments, but he somehow conflated that with friendship.
I got to know him very well because we were both on 60 Minutes. We were stablemates, and we did very well that night.
He has been going around claiming that Putin has called him brilliant.
I think when he calls me brilliant, I'll take the compliment, okay?
The word that actually Putin used translates into colorful or flamboyant. So I don't believe there is a mutual admiration society between the two. I think that that is mostly a figment of Mr. Trump's imagination. Trump's irresponsibility and clumsiness, though, does not excuse the American media from publishing fact-free, innuendo-laden stories.
You know, this is not to be an apologist for either man, especially since one of them invaded the Ukraine while lying about it the whole while. But that doesn't give the press permission to buy any anti-Putin, anti-Trump storyline uncritically.
Correct. I mean, with all the material, the rich, rich material that he has given us to question his motives, why rely so heavily on this borderline fictitious so-called bromance with Vladimir Putin? To do as, say, The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg, to say that Donald J. Trump has chosen to unmask himself as a de facto agent of Russian President Vladimir Putin, it's a very, very ugly echo of McCarthyism.
I guess I have to ask you at this stage if you need to be unmasked as an agent or stooge of the Kremlin. Do you draw a paycheck from Russia today or anything like that I should know of?
No, but that is characteristic of the criticism that I've received and a few others far more prominent than me have received simply for questioning American policy. I happen to think that NATO expansion was a horrible mistake and has a lot to do with Russia's behavior. Now, explaining Russia's behavior isn't excusing Russia's behavior. There's no excuse for the annexation of Crimea, but it would help to explain where they're coming from. But what people who object to that line of thinking tend to overly rely on is ad hominem attacks.
Well, let's, for the moment, just go to one narrow subject, and that is the hacked emails that WikiLeaks released. All the evidence so far is that the provenance of these was Russian hackers, maybe organized criminals, maybe vandals. We don't really know what motivated them. So how have we covered that story wrong, and how could we have done it right?
It seems to me that the reporting has largely been not so much reporting, but stenography. The major newspapers have simply been repeating the claims of the Director of National Intelligence, and they've been repeating Hillary Clinton's fairly questionable claim that all 17 intelligence agencies have come to the conclusion that the Russians did it. I think that a better way to do it would be to cover it with a touch of skepticism. Journalists and the government and journalists and corporations, journalists against really anyone with lots of power, there should be an adversarial relationship there. That's the point of the Fourth Estate. And after all, the U.S. government and the intelligence community in particular has well earned that skepticism, given its performance, say, for instance, in the lead up to the Iraq War.
I would assert to you that the U.S. press definitely has a double standard, but the double standard applies not just to Putin, but to anybody who we more or less agree is a bad guy. Covering Erdogan in Turkey or the North Korean regime, we seem to have a much lower threshold of evidence. Is this a Russia thing, or is this just a consensus thing?
I think we go through different periods of media-induced hysteria regarding one foreign figure or another. 25 years ago, in the lead-up to the Gulf War, George H.W. Bush, who was, I think, an otherwise exemplary foreign policy president, embarked on a campaign of demonization of Saddam Hussein, comparing him to Hitler and the like. And we haven't been able to shake that habit. And there are very understandable objections to Russia's foreign policy and their domestic politics. But we are allied with regimes that are far more sinister than the Russian regime. And I here in mind, I have the Gulf state tyrannies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And they receive little scrutiny.
So you're not saying you're worried about poor Russia. You're saying
I'm worried about poor us. I'm worried about this sort of reckless posture we have. Whether we like it or not, in order to get things done, some very important things done, we need to cooperate with them. Now, look at President Obama's foreign policy record. You can't point to too many achievements, but the ones that you can point to, like the Iranian nuclear deal or getting rid of Assad's chemical weapons, that couldn't have been done without Russia. They are a potential partner, but instead we're treating them as an adversary. And that's extremely opportunistic and unfortunately short-sighted and ultimately very dangerous.
James, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
James Carden is the executive editor of the nonpartisan American Committee for East-West Accord. Coming up, Glenn Beck wants you to know that he's a changed man. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy over and over and over again who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're Glenn Beck, ex-CNN, ex-Fox News Channel, current bellows-in-chief at the website The Blaze. First on TV and now online, Beck has spent more than a decade preaching about Byzantine plots, biblical prophecies, and a general gospel of calamity, all hidden in plain view if you, the victim, could but open your eyes and see.
We're done as a nation. When Mitch McConnell says, now is not the time to end abortion, we're done as a nation. We're not going to get any more warnings on this. Evil is rampaging right now. It is beyond anything that I have ever seen anywhere in my life. And if you think it's going to stay put, if you think it's not going to grow, if you think this is as bad as it could get, you are sadly mistaken.
Part polemicist, part conspiracy theorist, part televangelist, Beck's special sauce is what logicians call the fallacy of favorable enumeration, and what the rest of us call cherry-picking, selecting unconnected facts or bizarre non-facts, and drawing connections between them as to reveal some sinister pattern. It's a classically empty form of argument, not to mention very often just Looney Tunes. Here's Beck talking about FEMA concentration camps, where the government can lock up troublesome patriots.
They're not FEMA trailers, FEMA prisons, FEMA camps. If you trust our government, it's fine. If you have any kind of fear that we might be headed towards a totalitarian state, look out, buckle up. We are a country that is headed towards socialism, totalitarianism, beyond your wildest imagination.
Plus, just enough ad hominem to keep it all interesting. Michelle Obama is a monster. Al Gore is Hitler. Bill Clinton is the Antichrist. Oh, and fat people don't deserve to live.
You know those fat people that sit in their couch, and I mean really fat. I mean, not like me. I mean the people who, like, their skin grows into the couch, and then, you know, they call the fire department, they cut them out of the wall, and then they have to bring in a truck, and then they take them to the hospital. I say let them die. I say punish the person who's been bringing them the milkshakes that allowed them to eat and not get up off the couch. Maybe, am I too harsh?
Yes, Glenn, much. But never fear, because Beck now claims to be a new man. For the past few months, he's been visiting the camps of the enemy: Rolling Stone, Vice, Charlie Rose, MSNBC, The New York Times, to pronounce himself chastened and Donald Trump a historic threat. He's contrite, introspective, empathetic. After a decade of vitriol incitement and literal demonization, he is backpedaling at 60 miles an hour.
I am reinforcing and I'm retooling for the future, as every business should be, knowing that if you don't retool every three, 4 years, you're going to be out of business. So I'm retooling that. As far as message, I hope I'm different.
Glenn Beck, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much, Bob.
You're different. Different how?
I don't know. I'm trying to be a better listener. You know, it's one thing to come out, 3 years ago and say, you know, holy cow, not my intent, and I made things much worse, I think.
That was the Megyn Kelly interview, right?
Yes.
And we'll get to that. What is different now from the course correction that you tried to make 3 years ago?
I mean, it's an ongoing thing from there. I said in that interview how I don't know what I would have done differently. And I still don't necessarily know what I would have done differently, other than shut your mouth more and listen more.
Well, who was the old Glenn Beck, the one who was running his mouth too much and listening too little?
The same guy. I still believe the same things. I still have the same principles. But my principles weren't always on display. And it's what's causing me so much trouble with this Donald Trump thing. You know, I don't agree with Hillary Clinton at all. And I think she's wildly dangerous with the corruption just in the FBI and the Justice Department. But that doesn't mean that I lose my principles and do whatever it takes to stop her or to sign on board with somebody who, yes, is trying to stop her, but also doesn't reflect my principles.
But let's talk about Trumpism. We have this presidential candidate who has made many unsubstantiated charges. He has shown no interest in the law, domestic or international. He's threatened allies. He's cozied up to enemies. He's espoused policies that would trample on the Bill of Rights, all playing to a crowd that you have been inciting for more than a decade. Did you create Trumpism?
I think inciting is a rather inflammatory word. When I went around in 2004, and I was trying to say at that time, people feel like they're disconnected from the system. My intent was to let off steam. For instance, the 9/12 Project, which is always confused with the Tea Party. I was actually against the Tea Party when it first started. And I started something called the 9/12 Project, which was wildly different. And it was based on 9 values and 12 principles. And I said, we can't make this about politics. This has to be about principles. It's why my audience should be gone right now. But my audience actually has held stable in the ratings. Now, Sean Hannity and everybody else is way through the roof because they're playing into it.
You told the New York Times, quote, we need to listen to one another as human beings and try to understand one another's pain. Now, I think you were speaking specifically of Black Lives Matter, but in general, you were making a case for empathy, correct?
Yes.
Riff.
You know, the one thing that that I didn't do in 2008 and 9, I hadn't studied Martin Luther King like I have in the last few years. And Martin Luther King had it right. And our entire society is built on winning. And when we're set to win, we all lose. We have to find a way to reconcile with one another. And it doesn't mean that we agree with one another, but we have to listen. And there are these groups, for instance, Black Lives Matter. I don't agree with the leadership and their stated goals, but that doesn't mean that I don't listen to the people who are part of that movement. And that's where we missed it on the Tea Party. And what you're seeing with Donald Trump is the fact that the media never listened. They immediately deemed them all racists. Well, you're seeing now that there is a racist group. It's called the alt-right. And everybody needs to band together and corral those people and make sure we can identify them and not group them into one large group and say, everybody who is a conservative is a racist. No, that's what the media did. And that's why so many people gave up on even being listened to. And because I experienced that myself and I saw it happen, I realize, wait a minute, that's what's about to happen, except the right is going to do it to Black Lives Matter. We have to listen to the people who are actually in there, who are saying, look, there's a problem in our community. We need help. How do we solve this?
Is the world ready to take listening and empathy lessons from Glenn Beck?
No.
Well, precisely. I mean, you have, just to cite a few examples, declared your disgust with families of 9/11 victims. You have
untrue.
Used...
That's untrue. I was raising money for people that were affected by Hurricane Katrina. When people started to see people shooting and looting, I said, those are not the average person. That is the anomaly that you are seeing on television. At the same time that was happening, there were 9/11 victims' families who were trying to bilk and milk the system. And I said specifically, there are those people that you look at and you say, oh my gosh, I don't want anything to do with them. I'm so sick of all of them. No, don't be sick of all of them. Don't lump everybody into one group. When you see somebody you disagree with, especially when you're being asked to open your heart.
Glenn, permit me to take you on a trip down bad memory lane.
You know, it took me about a year to start hating the 9/11 victims' families. It took me about a year. And I had such compassion for them, and I really, you know, I wanted to help them, and I was behind, you know, let's give them money, let's get started, you know, all of this stuff. And I really didn't, you know, all the 3,000 victims' families, I don't hate all of them. I hate probably about 10 of them. But when I see, you know, 9/11 victim family, you know, on television or whatever, I'm just like, oh, shut up. I'm so sick of them because they're always complaining, and we did our best for them.
Okay, now I don't really want to relitigate the issue of...
No, you don't have to because you've played it out of context. Now, nobody's going to say this, but out of 3,000, Are you telling me there aren't 10 of 3,000 people that are whining about one thing or another that annoy you? Yes. Was my language inflammatory to say I hate them? I don't hate them. I never hated them. This is probably what would change from me. I didn't realize the damage that I was doing. And I have to tell you, anybody who does 5 hours at their desk every day, does it all live, all unscripted, and was where I was at the time, believing what I believed, everyone will make mistakes. I'm not shying away from that. That audio, I said that. I would like to see people put it in context. Now, let me ask you a question, Bob. What good is relitigating Glenn Beck? I told you from the beginning, should you listen to me on Compassion? No. I'm the worst possible guy, but I'm the only guy right now that is actually standing up against his own tribe, if you will, and saying, I'm not going to worry about Hillary Clinton. I'm not going to worry about the Democrats. I'm not going to worry about the liberals. I'm just going to say, I'm not going over the cliff with the rest of the people in my tribe. And what, I mean, you don't have, but what good does it do now? Destroying Glenn Beck. Bob, people have been doing that for a long time. You're a little late to the party. What can we do to heal the nation instead of dividing? If you don't believe me, that's fine. Why have me on the show?
Well, let's have that conversation. You have mentioned that retooling or adjusting to the current business conditions is just part of the process of running a business like The Blaze or the Glenn Beck brand.
I'm going out of business. Haven't you heard that?
Well, there have been layoffs. The marketplace hasn't necessarily been kind to you lately. And if you do a little market analysis, on the paranoid wingnuttery side of it, you're losing market share to the likes of Alex Jones and his ravings.
Good. Good.
And on the hardcore nativist side, you're losing share to Breitbart.
Good.
He's got the alt-right wrapped up. And then there's the
Good.
Daily Caller and others. So,
Good.
So are you adjusting your message as a question of principle or because you're just trying to suss out a better
market
niche?
What does that leave me with, Bob? What does that leave me with? Do you think anybody in your audience is going to suddenly come to Glenn Beck and say, oh my gosh, I love this guy. I'm going to forget everything he said because I've got everybody on the left reminding me exactly what he said for all time. So I'm going to give him a shot. Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think that the people, when I talk to you on NPR, when I talk to the New York Times or Charlie Rose, they look at that and go, oh, that's good. He's on our side. Or do they say, he's a total sellout. So where's my market, Bob?
Well, where is your market? And quick follow-up question, what's the purpose of the great 2016 Glenn Beck Empathy Tour?
This is the most remarkable interview I've ever done. And I've done some remarkable interviews.
Thank you. Why are you doing what you're doing?
You are so jaded that you can't even imagine that maybe somebody is doing it because they believe it.
Well, can I play you another piece of tape, if I might?
No, please? I've heard them all. You can play them and insert them into the interview.
I wish I could go back and be more uniting in my language because I think I played a role, unfortunately, in helping tear the country apart.
Well, that was 3 years ago. Was that a trial balloon? Because as I understand it, not a whole lot changed after that sort of moment of contrition and to the place we are now. What was going on in those intervening almost 3 years?
A lot of soul searching, a lot of raising money to help people in the Middle East. We have raised $11 million and saved 4,000 people and moved them into safety from Syria and from Iraq. Held a rally of about 30,000 people. Also, over a year of standing for principles against somebody who I think is as dangerous as Donald Trump and warning my own people who don't want to hear about the alt-right. They don't believe that there's such a thing as the alt-right. They believe this is a New York Times trope. Because who tells them that? Breitbart. Who tells them that? The Drudge Report. Who tells them that? Trump.
There have been a number of reinventions in your career, and you've acknowledged in the past that the Glenn Beck persona, what I would call the shtick, has elements of performance art. A rodeo clown is how you've described yourself. So have you fanned the flames of distrust in government and hatred and even insurrection as some sort of perverse entertainment? And just let me be clear, I regard that as a rhetorical question.
You're waiting for me to say something. You just said it was a rhetorical question, so.
Yeah, but I'd be happy to hear your response.
No, I don't think so. Hey, Bob, I really do wish you the best. I hope that someday you can take the time to find a moment where you'll give somebody the opportunity to actually change and try to do the right thing and stand not against the people where the crowds are cheering, but stand against the people where no one is cheering, where no one wants to stand, where no one wants to pay for anything, and know the difference between those two. And when you do, maybe you'll be able to see what I'm trying to do. But until that time, I'm deeply sorry that you misled us into thinking that this would be anything like a fair interview. And I thank you.
Glenn Beck is the proprietor of TheBlaze.com. In other repulsive cynicism news...
You know, as a Christian woman, I understand persecution, but I will not sit here and be persecuted because your information is totally false. Podesta's emails were stolen. You're so interested in talking about stolen material.
So you deny it.
You're like a thief that want to bring into the night the things that you found that was in the gutter.
Well, wasn't that an awkward conversation between Fox News Channel's Megyn Kelly and Democratic Party chairperson, I mean Clinton strategist, I mean CNN commentator, I mean Donna Brazile. This week, CNN announced that Brazile had resigned her post there, but in that interview a couple of weeks ago, Brazile still wasn't owning up to her crime, namely abusing her role as a CNN on-air talent to leak debate questions to the Hillary Clinton campaign. It was an outrage, obviously, and yes, people were outraged.
CNN was completely uncomfortable with the hacked email showing Brazile shared questions with the Clinton campaign before a primary debate.
Donna Brazile fed her questions in advance of at least two debates. That's cheating.
Why is Hillary not demanding that a person that cheated, Bernie Sanders, head of the DNC, is not fired?
Yeah, all that. Also, if I might add a word of sophisticated contextualization, duh. So the scorpion stung the frog. Who saw that coming? Come on, it is the nature of a political operative to be political. Not to be honest, not to be transparent, not to be fair, not to be truthful, not even to be illuminating. Merely to confer advantage to her party, period. Which is why Donna Brazile had no business being on CNN as a commentator to begin with. According to Politico, CNN President Jeffrey Zucker executive-splained that, quote, one bad apple doesn't ruin it for the entire process. But that is exactly wrong. It is the process, the hiring of partisan consultants as supposedly knowledgeable insiders, that is rotten to the core. CNN and Fox and MSNBC enlist those partisans to sell their various bills of goods. Whether it's former Trump campaign chairman Corey Lewandowski spinning fantasy for the GOP candidate.
He's doing well. He's bringing those Republicans home. He's doing much better amongst the African-American community than Mitt Romney did or John McCain did. He's doing well with Hispanic.
Or Democratic activist Van Jones decrying Trump's dithering on accepting election results.
Hillary Clinton, when you look at the fact checker, she's one of the most honest politicians in America.
Or Trumpista Jeffrey Lord offering a tinfoil hat scenario of voter fraud?
Just because I touch the button that says Donald Trump, it doesn't necessarily mean that it registers for Donald Trump.
Or former Democratic Governor Jennifer Granholm, or Obama strategist David Axelrod. What they have to say is politically preordained, a foregone conclusion, and therefore not commentary at all. It is native advertising, falsely presented by CNN and the other cable news channels as opinion journalism. So, yeah, Donna Brazile turned out to be a DNC mole in the very inner sanctum of CNN, and also that scorpion on the frog's back, and also a fox in the henhouse. Choose the nature metaphor of your choice. But spare me the surprise. The goal of such casting, after all, isn't audience understanding of the news, but ratings-driven spectacle. Who doesn't love an animal act when what you're running is the circus? That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Paige Cowett, Michael Loewinger, and Sara Khari. We had more help from Leia Fetter, and our show was edited by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.